back to the American Revolution podcast. Please don't adjust your dial. This is the American Revolution podcast. I know it's been a long, long absence, but we are back. We still have the same terrible audio like we always did, but we're still going to bring you the same great message that I've tried to every episode for 76 episodes now. This week, we're going to look at the Battle of Oriskany. Now, before I start, I want to just let everyone know that with everything going on in the world, I am working hard to continue doing research. I have all of this time off now. The baby is due in a couple of weeks, so that's a bit nerve-wracking, but I'm hoping that I can find an hour or so every day just to bring you a quality podcast as I have all of this time off. I've spent the first couple weeks of my quarantine writing several episodes that are going to bring us to the conclusion of our Saratoga campaign. Now, when we last left off, we had covered a lot. Burgoyne moving south, battles at places like Hubbardton and Fort Anne, and what's going on with the army. And we get into the Battle of Bennington. And that's, in a sense, where we left off before we moved into the Mohawk campaign. Now, I'm going to review the Mohawk campaign because I feel like that podcast should have been immediately followed up by Oriskany, and I feel like since there has been such a long lapse of time between me doing this episode and the most recent episode that I had done prior to all of what was going on, I feel like that's left a giant gaping hole. So we do need some time for review. So let's first review one thing that I think was overlooked. And there are situations that have popped up in the at this time in our story arc where we really have to look at what we will quote-unquote call the turning point of the American Revolution. Now, I said there are four distinct turning points to the American Revolution. Now, I haven't gone into all of them. I have pointed out so far one. And the first one was the Battle of Bennington. A lot of people said that the Battle of Bennington was a turning point in the American Revolution because it severely cut the amount of troops and support that Burgoyne would have had coming into the Saratoga battle. It also proved that he wasn't going to find Tories, you know, just climbing out of the woodwork, ready to flock to his banner. He got very little support, actually, from Hudson colonials that were living in the area. They were actually a very pro-patriot faction. He wasn't getting the Tory support that he thought he would. Now, when we got into the Mohawk campaign, there was a large Tory faction in the Mohawk Valley. But the problem was that they needed to get access to it. So I had started episode 75 by shifting to the west. We had left Burgoyne on the Hudson after Bennington, just north of, in the area of Fort Edward, Fort Anne, and north of what will be the Saratoga battlefield. And as I shifted west, I said I would lay out a few episodes where we're talking about Burgoyne's second arm to his force. Remember, he had a three-prong attack that was planned. The first was him moving south from Canada. The second was going to be Howe coming up from the New York City area with troops to move into Albany. And then the last was going to be this force under Barry St. Ledger. Now, we've already dispelled the notion that Howe was going to come and work with Burgoyne. Howe saw an opportunity, he was going to take it, and we're going to discuss that when we get into Brandywine and what's going on with General Washington's army as we move into that battle after Saratoga. Now, the two battles happen around about the same time with Brandywine battle happening only a few days before the start of Saratoga. But because this was such a long arcing campaign and had taken most of the summer for us to get there, it actually even started back in 1776 with the battles in Quebec, or that was 1775, with the battles in Quebec, then Benedict Arnold's Navy, Battle of Valcour Island. Now we have moved down in here. So this has been a really long arching campaign from trying to garner support for the rebels in Canada to where we end up in September and October of 1777. So Barry St. Ledger is moving from Oswego down the Mohawk River. The plan is to meet Burgoyne in Albany. This was a key area for the British for two reasons. The first, there was the frontier of the New York colony. The British would be able to establish a presence there. They hadn't already. They didn't have much of a presence there. The Mohawk Valley was also the opening to the Iroquois nations, which, for the most part, was a supporter of the British. The interesting thing was that the Iroquois Confederacy has six nations: the Mohawks, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, the Senecas, the Oneidas, and the Tuscaroras. This was the largest Indian group that we would see in the Northeast, and most of them would follow the British. The ones that tend to lean towards supporting the Americans were the Oneidas, and then elements of the Senecas and the Tuscaroras. Not all, but some. So, in a sense, you had almost two out of the six that weren't in agreement. So, the Iroquois Confederacy was, in itself, having its own civil war. The other thing is, in this area, I said there was a definite neighbor-versus-neighbor vibe, because you have Tories and Patriots living very closely. And the whole purpose of this expedition was to take those Tories and the Indian support from the Mohawk and bring that down. So when St. Ledger is planning this attack, he is now making up for the numbers that they will lose in Bennington if he gets to Albany, because he'll have that Tory and Indian support that Burgoyne was so desperately looking for. Okay, so this wasn't a planned episode, and of course having my dog barking in the background is always a fun thing. So, the vast river valley is home to 5,000 people from all over Western Europe. With the frontiers being so divided, you find that different counties hold different support. And Tryon County, which is where our future episodes are going to be taking place, was considered to be a Tory stronghold. The most powerful family in the area, the Johnsons, were not only Tory, but had a great relationship with the Indians. In 1774, William Johnson was director of Indian Affairs and was the one who really developed this close relationship with the Indians until his passing. His son-in-law, Colonel Guy Johnson, assumed the post as director of Indian Affairs. Both sides sought aid from the Six Nations. So in August of 1775, a great council fire in Albany, the Confederacy voted to stay out of the conflict, calling it a family matter. British and colonists. My apologies. This was a bit disconcerting for the British, because they had held the belief that they had the loyalty of the Iroquois for 100 years. They helped them win wars with the Algonquins. The Oneida and the Tuscaroras were the ones that really leaned towards that American support, while the other four were happy with staying neutral. Well, when the Oneidas and the Tuscaroras jumped the line, it tends to split the I guess you would say the Confederacy. So now we see an Indian civil war, where we now have the Confederacy split between the four factions that would side with the British and the two factions with some supporters from the other side, like the Senecas, joining the Americans. Okay, so that's it's kind of the background to the story of the political side of things. Okay, now we're going to look at Fort Stanwyck, and we're going to review just really quick what we thought about what we're going to get into as we go into the Battle of Oriskany and the Siege of Fort Stanwix. So, in the summer of 1777, the British expedition was going to move down the Mohawk Valley. The principal defense was Fort Stanwix. It was built in 1758. It sported bomb-proof bastions, covered barracks, large picketed ditch. But this was, once again, a F&I fort built for the French and Indian Wars and to protect against Indian raiding in the post-war years. 20 years later, the fort is a shell of what it used to be. So Colonel Peter Gainsbrut of the 3rd New York Continentals was the man who took over the fort and quoted it as saying it was not only indefensible but untenable. But Gainsbrut and his second-in-command, Lieutenant Colonel Marinus Willett, were competent and energetic officers, and they went to work trying to rebuild the defenses once again. No matter what the condition of the fort, they needed to hold this fort to make sure that the access to the Mohawk River Valley was defended from British incursions from Canada. So we mentioned that Barry St. Ledger was the man chosen for the job to move down and move through the Mohawk Valley, collect that Indian support, collect those Tories, and overtake the defenses at Fort Stanwix. He's doing this with a combined force of 875 men, 200 British regulars, 133 Tories, 350 Jaegers. He had a number of Canadian militia, some axemen. He also had 40 artillerymen with 2 6-pounders, 2 3-pounders, and 4 Coehorn mortars. Joseph Brant, the Indian war chief, brought a force of 800 to 1,000 Indian supporters to the British. So standing to oppose Fort Stanwix and overtake its defenses was in the ballpark of 1,900 men of arms. So on July 26th, this force started for Fort Stanwix. It was thought to be a dilapidated fort with a mere 60-man garrison. But, as we're going to review in future episodes, it is not. Now, we're going to move into the Battle of Oriskany. We have set the stage. And this was the purpose of episode 76, was to really focus in on the Battle of Oriskany. So this episode is going to be rather long, not just because we're talking about the Battle of Oriskany, but I wanted to make sure that I covered the lead-up, and we reviewed that one last time. So, the return of the Tories, and especially Joseph Brant, with his Indians and the British support, saw the mood in the valley change. Patriots were understandably worried, in some cases claiming Tory loyalty. I would too. Seeing all of that Indian support. Indians have been credited with having some bad habits when on campaign or when on the warpath. I mean, you got to remember, a lot of the men who are now older, some of the commanders in these areas, commanders of militia, remember the French and Indian days. Okay? A lot of the men fighting were children during the French and Indian War days, especially in colonial New York. So hearing that Joseph Brant is at the head of a column of 1,000 Indians is really changing the mood in the valley. And some of those that are not, you know, fully supported to the Patriot cause or have loose ties to the Patriot cause, well, you're going to see them turn to Tories very quickly. You know, they're going to be fair weather loyalists. If everything looks like it's turning in favor of the loyalists and the British, they're going to be on that side. Once everything turns back, hey, yay, Patriots. So we have that fair weather fan aspect in the Mohawk Valley at the time. Nicholas Herkimer, however, was the brigadier general of the county militia, and he was a man that would solidify the Patriot resolve. Herkimer was a French and Indian War veteran and had over 50. And at over 50 years old, was the most able commander in the Mohawk Valley. They don't get much better than this man. He knew his stuff. He knew how the Indians fought in the area, and especially he knew the terrain. So on July 17th, even before the British began their march down the valley, he puts out the call for any able-bodied man 16 to 60 to come and oppose the British. Those that were considered to be too old or invalids should prepare to defend their homes, because if they fail, well, those that were loyal to the rebellion, they're going to see firsthand what the Indians may do. Now, I want to keep the siege and the battle as separate episodes, so we're going to focus today strictly on Oriskany, okay? So everything we talk about going forward is going to focus on the battle itself. St. Leger had to take the fort, but if he was going to take the valley. So he ordered 30 of his regulars and 200 Indians under Joseph Brant to cut off any supplies and reinforcements that were on their way. This advance force arrived on the 2nd, barely missing a convoy that dropped off supplies and brought 200 more men. They were able to capture one of the boats, killing one and wounding two others, and take the captain prisoner. The next day, so on August 3rd, St. Leger arrives. The first thing he did was make a display of force. He demonstrated in front of the fort, so the defenders could see the red-coated British, the Germans in blue, and the green coats of the Jaegers and the Tories. More importantly, they saw 1,000 half-naked and war-painted Indians. This was meant to scare its defenders and to kind of show that, well, the Indians are with us, and if you don't do what we say, well, I'll just unleash them on you. St. Leger sent a message on a flag of truce that if they abandoned the fort, no harm would come to them, and explained that Burgoyne was on his way to capturing the Hudson. But there isn't any kind of response. So St. Leger sent to work as preparing his siege. Herkimer had called out the militia on July 30th, learning of St. Leger's advance. They were going to meet at Fort Dayton, 30 miles down the valley from Fort Stanwyck, and then they were going to march to the fort's aid. Herkimer would leave on August 4th at the head of 800 men. He was also joined by 60 Oneida Indians that would act as his scouts. He sent runners ahead with a message for Gainsvrut to signal with 3 cannon shots. To signal that he got the message. Gainsvrut would sortie when the relief column was near so that Herkimer would not be overwhelmed. He made it within 8 miles of the fort, but there were still no cannon shots. Did Gainsvrut get the message? Herkimer wanted to wait and see if a signal would come, but his officers wanted to go on. Herkimer was hesitant and was called a coward and a Tory. Now, as we continue on, we're going to see some hindsight being 2020, but if I was Herkimer, I would have trusted my gut, regardless of what people were saying about me. Herkimer agreed. He wanted to show that he was a resolute patriot, and he marched off at the head of his column on top of his white horse. Hearing word of Herkimer's advance coming, St. Leger wanted to engage this force before they could get to the fort. 6 miles from the fort, the road passes Oriskany village. There the road cuts through a ravine about 50 feet deep. St. Leger's plan was one out of the Patriots' playbook. He would post men at the west end of the ravine, halting the advance. Then another force would come down from the sides of the ravine, surrounding and overwhelming Herkimer. St. Leger planned to annihilate this force. The forces he sent were a portion of the Royal Greens and Butler's Rangers, and their job was to block the valley so that the force could not advance any farther. For the general assault, he sent Joseph Brant with his entire force of Indians, all 1,000 of them. This was a well-laid-out plan, but it was made even better by early mistakes by Patriot forces. First, the Oneida scouts had not picked up on the hint of an attack. Maybe they were just well hidden, but no one really knows. But the Oneida scouts, who were supposed to be the lookouts. They have no clue that this trap is about to happen. It also didn't help that Herkimer didn't order out any flankers. This is definitely a big deal because if you look at the battle map of Oriskany, he cuts right through the ravine, like I said, and, well, if you had flankers out, you would have men on the top of the ravine observing what was going on up there to protect your main body, which is moving through the lower part of the ravine. They would have been able to alert the column to the advancing Indians, and then they would have been able to readjust, move, pull back out of the ravine, whatever they have to do. They would have been prepared for the attack, but as we're going to see, they're not ready. And so the supplies for these 800 men are on ox carts, and as they make their way into the ravine, this trap is sprung because the ox carts can't back out, so the men are kind of boxed in. The Indians jump into action. This is a mistake because the Indians spring into action too soon. Now, when they spring into action, the ox cart blocks the ravines as planned, but for the men in the ravine. The others on the outside of it see this and will begin to run off or to find a safer location. Herkimer's hearing that the rear of his column is running away. So he rides out to try and stop them, except in the middle of all this, the Tories and the Indians attack. Herkimer is shot, his horse is shot from under him, and his leg is wounded in the attack. The circle is complete. Into this disorganized mess, the Indians would attack with knife and tomahawk. To protect themselves, the Patriots formed a defensive circle so that they had protection on all sides. This was the key. Those troops that joined with Herkimer saved the lives of so many men by performing a defensive circle. Because either way, the Americans would have been picked apart piece by piece and totally annihilated. Herkimer's plan is he gets his men to a bit of high ground. And what he does is he forms a circle. And in that circle, he's placed in the middle so that he can control things and organize his men as they go. He says to partner up in twos and threes. Now, the reason that they partnered up is that when I'm a single soldier and I'm fighting, if I shoot, a common Indian battle tactic is to, you hear a shot go off by a soldier, then you charge him and you can tomahawk him, knife him, whatever you got to do. This has been proven, and you can look up videos online. An Indian can close the distance from 30 yards out, even 50 yards out, in the time that it takes a man to reload his musket. Now, here's the thing. In that time, if I shoot and I have my buddy, when the Indian presents himself and charges at me, my buddy takes a shot and he can put down the attacker. Now the Indians get savvy to this, and you see this kind of exchange of fire start happening, where the Americans are shooting at whatever they see, and as they're shooting, the Indians would charge, but their partner or their triplets, if they had threes, would return fire and attack anyone that was charging the line. So now we start to see this exchange, and it becomes a definite bloody fight, and the fighting is hot and dirty. The Indians would continue this probing of the line. When things got too close quarters, knives, tomahawks, bayonets, using muskets as clubs were going to be the choices. And this carries on for 45 minutes. Now imagine this going on and on for 45 minutes. Your head is on a swivel. You don't know where to look. You don't know what's going to happen next. And then there's a break. A sudden downpour causes the ceasing of fire. In that time, Herkimer puts his men together and consolidates his lines. His men have to, you know, shore up their partners, shore up whatever defenses they have. After about an hour, the rain stops, and like halftime at a football game, the fight resumes. Another force of Royal Greens under Major Watts arrives, and they turn their coats inside out because they thought they could get in close. But unfortunately, their rouse is discovered, and some more hand-to-hand fighting ensues. By late in the afternoon, the Indians had completely lost interest in the fight, and they're pulling back. They actually suffered more casualties than they were expecting. So without the Indians, the Tories will break off their attack, and then soon followed by the regulars. Herkimer's men could not continue. They had about 50 wounded, including their general. They had to return to Fort Dayton. The numbers of losses were not recorded by either side, but it is believed that of the militia, they have somewhere in the vicinity of 150 to 200 men killed, with the other 50 wounded, and about 150 killed and wounded for the Tories and the Indians. Now, I've always said that these battles, you have to look at them from the sample size that you have. When we look at everything from the beginning, Herkimer had 800 men. 200 are killed, estimated, but still, 200 are killed. That means one quarter of his force is decimated. A bunch more are going to run off because of the sudden and ferocious attack of the Indians, and 50 are wounded. For the Tories and the Indians, they lose 150 killed and wounded. The butcher bill for the Indians was significantly higher than the Tories and the Indians because the Tories and the Indians were the Tories were firing from positions and more similar tactics that the Americans would do. The Indians sought glory, and they wanted to cut down the Patriots, and they wanted to do it by hand. So they charged into battle headlong with tomahawk and knife. And once Herkimer put his men to work firing in pairs, he really opened up the floodgates for really returning some of that decimation to the Indians. It really hurt, especially Indian morale, to have a lot, you know, probably in the vicinity of 100 to 125 men killed or wounded. You know, because remember, Joseph Brant came with all 800 to 1,000 of his fighters. The Tories and the Jaegers brought 200 men to the fight. So this is clearly a one-sided casualty list, and it's definitely squarely in the Indians. So it's not surprising that by the afternoon, seeing that they're not really getting anywhere anymore, they had their fill of bloodlust early in the battle, and now they're just sending wave after wave of Indians against this pretty well-positioned, American circle. They're seeing a lot of their troops go down. The biggest loss would be for Herkimer. Now, he has his leg busted. His horse fell on it, broke it. I believe there was also a bullet hole in it. His leg had to be amputated. There was no rescuing it. But like you're going to see, like you would see in Civil War history, similar in sometimes even worse in Revolutionary War history, more men would die from infections from their wounds a lot of the times than actual deaths on the battlefield. They, you know, sickness and disease could kill sometimes a lot easier than the bayonet or a round shot from a British musket. So that's a key thing to remember. And the loss of Herkimer definitely hurt the Tryon County militia. But as we're going to see with the siege, the hope for Fort Stanwyck and the Mohawk Valley is not totally lost. So that's going to do it for this week. I know this was a very long episode, a lot longer than you're accustomed to. I'm a man that really believes that that 20-minute mark is the right spot that you want to end, and I've exceeded that greatly. But we're going to look into next week, the siege of Fort Stanwyck. I just wanted to thank everyone for the kind words. It's been really hard for me and my family. We hit a lot of things hit at once. We had gotten married, and I continued the podcast for a little while, but then money became a real struggle, and then we found out we were pregnant, and then money became an even bigger struggle because we found out we were pregnant. But now things seem to be moving in a more positive direction, where things are looking a little bit better, and with all this time for quarantine, I have lots of time to focus on teaching my students, because we're doing virtual learning. I can do my schoolwork. My assessment has been put on hold because I'm not in my classroom. So it's really opened me up for more times, not a whole lot more, but some more time for hobbies. And one thing that I would like to resurrect, as it were, are the book recommendations. I've gone through many recommendations, and there is one that I would like to lead off this set of podcasts, now that we're focusing on Saratoga. The first is Eric Lazader's Saratoga. I think that there are three very good comprehensive books that really look at the battles that happen here along the Hudson River Valley and subsequently what's going on in the Mohawk. And Lazader's book does a great job of giving a nice story arc for all of that. He's not going to be the only person that I recommend that has written a book about the battles in these areas and some of the key players in these areas, but his is a very good one. I know that my friends at the Saratoga National Historical Park are saying, hey man, what about, the book that we told you to read when you first started working there? And I will get to that one, but I figured I would save what is considered the Holy Bible for Rangers working at Saratoga for when we actually get to the battles of Saratoga. So until next time, I want to thank everyone, and my plan is to hopefully get this all organized and set up and posted as soon as I'm done. So hopefully by tomorrow morning, you will see it in your podcast library. Until then, I just want to thank everyone for all of their support. Please go to iTunes if you have the ability to. Leave that 5-star rating. Otherwise, tell a friend. Nothing works better than word of mouth. Just tell a friend about the podcast. The podcast is back up and moving, and just let people know that it's out there. So until next week, everyone have a great and glorious week. And as always, keep that powder dry.